So we're reading this evening from Jonah chapter 1 and 2. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like one, please do raise your hand and I'm sure someone will bring one. It will be really helpful if you can follow the words. We're on page 653 of the Blue Church Bibles, 653, and we're going to start with Jonah chapter 1. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God, and they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us, and we will not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots to find out who is responsible for this calamity." They cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. So they asked him, "Tell us, who is responsible for making all this trouble for us? What do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" He answered, "I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." This terrified them, and they asked, "What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord because he had already told them so. The sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, "What should we do to you to make the sea calm down for us?" "Pick me up and throw me into the sea," he replied, "and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you." Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder than before. Then they cried to the Lord, "O Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. For you, O Lord, have done as you pleased." Then they took Jonah, they threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and three nights. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, "In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, 'I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple.' The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. But you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord. And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land.
Well, boredom is a big problem in our society. And we see evidence of it all around us, don't we? In graffiti, in vandalism, in violence, and a number of other, perhaps lower level ways. If someone or something doesn't hold our attention for more than a few minutes, they or it become, well, boring. In fact, the definition of boring has probably changed over time from just a task that was so repetitive and mundane to our meaning today, which covers anything or anyone that is not interesting or exciting, or just to be fed up. Boredom is particularly evident among the young, but not exclusively so, as we shall see. But have you ever asked a preteen or a teenager to stop doing one thing and to suggest that they do something else? So you ask the question. The response, nothing to do. So as a helpful parent, you might say, well, why don't you do such and such? Boring. And I did try that again this week, and it worked to a T. It absolutely works all the time. Now, and I also remember some years ago talking to my German tutor when I was trying to improve my language skills as a mature student, for all the good it did, but he was bemoaning the fact that he'd had to ban a particular response to the homework that he'd set. And the homework would often be something like this. It would be, you know, write a diary over the weekend in German of what you've done. And the response he'd had to ban was simply this. Es war langweilig, ich habe nichts gemacht. It was boring. I didn't do anything. No tips for you youngsters there. But being bored, you know, it's not confined to the young. Indeed, adults too have something of a fascination with it. And as I've said, the meaning of the word has probably changed. It can be long-term tedium, short-term tedium, or just being fed up. Many adults change their car, their job, or their partner because they're bored with them. And so they look for one that's more interesting or exciting than the previous one. And just taking this fascination with boredom one step further, there was a survey carried out last year, 2015, and it sought to find out the top 50 most boring things about modern British life. And the results of that survey were covered in many of the national newspapers. Well, what were the results? Well, at 50 was Alan Titchmarsh. Company meetings at 44. Shakespeare was at 36. David Cameron, cricket and Formula One all made the top 30. Gordon Brown, darts and selfies made the top 20. And then going down from 10, we had advertising breaks, train delays, waiting for a delivery, slow Wi-Fi, doctor's waiting rooms, number 5, shopping channels, 4, traffic jams, 3, queuing at the post office, 2, being kept on hold, and number 1, party political broadcasts. You know, it's boring just saying those words. Now, the survey found that over 7 in 10 adults admitted to leading a boring lifestyle, and almost half considered themselves a boring person. And this stat I struggled with. A third said they were tired of their jobs, but well over half said they got bored on their days off. Well, so many things cause us to be bored or fed up. And friends, you might be bored right now. One commentator on the book of Jonah notes that there was not much to do for 3 days inside a fish. And I wonder if a similar survey had been carried out in Jonah's time, what would have been in his top 3? You know, because Jonah was fed up about a number of things. He seems to have been fed up with being asked to go to Nineveh to preach, even though he'd only been asked once. He seemed to be bored or fed up with God's compassion, and you'd see that more later on in the book. Fed up with his own existence because he was happy, or happy perhaps the wrong word, but to forfeit his life. And yes, fed up with being inside a fish for 3 days. So friends, we're in the book of Jonah, looking at chapter 2, particularly the chapter that Stuart read to us. And you may remember we've been here before. This book's one of the minor prophets, just 4 chapters. We looked in June last year at chapter 1. We're in chapter 2 now. At this rate of progress, we should be finished the whole book by summer 2017. Well, most of the focus of the book of Jonah is always on chapter 1. Loved by Sunday school teachers, scorned by skeptics. Probably because the Sunday school teacher, for the Sunday school teacher, because it's so dramatic. Probably for the skeptic, because it's so unbelievable. But there's a marked difference between chapter 1 and chapter 2. After all of the adventure, the drama, and the disobedience of chapter 1, when Jonah refused God's command to preach to Nineveh and obviously ran away, we move to the prayer of the awakened backslider, or someone who's come to their senses and realizes afresh that, you know, there is a God in heaven who is faithful, who is powerful, who is gracious. Verse 17 at the end of chapter 1 probably could just as easily be in chapter 2. After all that had happened to Jonah, he's in a fish and he's at the end of the line. Poor Jonah. Now, even though I mentioned it last time, I should just point out that, yes, the Bible does say that Jonah was swallowed by a large fish. Now, some people use this as just another reason to confirm, really, how ridiculous the Bible narrative is. Others of us, though, simply accept that this is true, as it's captured here in God's Word. You know, in fact, there's around 10 miracles in the book of Jonah, so I'm not sure why the focus is always just on this one. Either God performed miracles or he didn't. Picking and choosing which ones we want to believe reduces the Bible to no more than pleasant fiction. And one very good reason to believe that this is true is that Jesus confirms it as historical narrative in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 40. And if we believe in God, the Creator, is it really too much to ask or to think that he could not ensure that one little tiny part of his creation was somewhere in the Mediterranean Sea, ready to catch his errant prophet Jonah? We do need to be careful, don't we? Because we can simply rationalize all these events and we end up with a God of our own making, one who couldn't really create the world, one who couldn't part the Red Sea, one who couldn't provide a fish for Jonah, one who can't forgive our sins and change lives. So we believe by faith all that is written here. But what happened then? Well, there's a number of things that we could look at in this chapter. We could see Jonah as a type of Christ and explore biblical typology. We could compare and contrast the chapter with the Psalms, and there are some great similarities. Or we could use Jonah as a picture of baptism. Then one commentary I looked at was even seeking to determine whether the great fish was male or female. Well, it may or may not be a relief to you that I'm not going to follow any of those strands. But in the time remaining, just to consider two very brief points. And they cover Jonah's distress, verses 1 to 6, and Jonah's deliverance in verses 7 to 10. And hopefully it will help us to better understand Jonah and help us to better understand ourselves, maybe. First then, Jonah's distress. So he's inside the fish and he literally had nowhere to go. He's at the end of the line. What does Jonah do? What did Jonah do? Well, he prayed. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. And you think, why did Jonah pray? Well, it's obvious, isn't it, from the text. He was in distress. In my distress, I called to the Lord. Now, would he have prayed if he wasn't in distress? There was opportunity, wasn't there, more than once on the ship to do that, in verse 6 and explicitly in verse 11 and other places he could have prayed, but he didn't take it. I wonder why he didn't take that opportunity. Was it the wrong time or the wrong place? I was looking at one of the commentators, Matthew Henry, an old commentator, lived back in 1660 to 1700s. He reminds us that God is accessible at all times when he says that he that has Christ dwelling in his heart by faith, wherever he goes, carries his altar with him. He's just saying that, you know, any place is a good place to pray. Any time is a good time. And the sense of Jonah's distress seems to me to be perhaps even stronger in the Old Authorized Version, where it says, I cried by reason of mine affliction unto the Lord, and he heard me. It seems that Jonah almost couldn't quite believe that God had responded to his call. It seems to be reinforced, doesn't it, in the second half of the verse. Out of the belly of hell I cried, from the depths of the grave in this version, and he heard my voice. Can you imagine Jonah thinking, wow, he heard me after all I've done, or in this case, after all I've not done? What about us? What about us? So often, you know, we turn to God, or we turn back to God, or we turn to God only in our distress or in our affliction. And why is that? Why is that? Maybe as a non-Christian, you turn to God to get out of a fix. And you make all sorts of promises to God that, of course, you'll never keep, but only if you can just get out of this fix, then you'll do all sorts of things. Maybe as a Christian, you turn to God only in your distress. And again, I wonder why that is. Is it because we're doing okay most of the time? We don't really feel like we need anything. Life's bobbing along just fine, a few minor ups and downs, but all pretty manageable stuff. And I wonder sometimes if we almost seem to have a, you know, make an unwritten contract with God, a sort of divine insurance policy. God, I'll continue in the Christian life, as long as I have a reasonably nice life, decent job, a couple of holidays a year, reasonable car, nice family. I mean, I don't want any problems, no trouble, diseases, anything like that, or accidents to deal with. And, you know, in return, I'll pitch up on a Sunday, most weeks, maybe even twice if I'm, you know, feeling spiritual that week. I'll put a few quid in the collection to salve my conscience, as long as there's nothing else I want to spend it on, of course. Friends, if that's our secret view of God's plan for us, then we're as deluded as the prophet Jonah was here. But why would a God of compassion put Jonah through the mill like this? Well, to show Jonah again that he is a God of grace and compassion. And so that Jonah would come to his senses again. And to understand that God requires our complete obedience. You know, his compassion is great, but he needed Jonah to believe that again in his heart, not just have a tacit acknowledgement of it in his head. Now, Jonah's distress here, it's very clear. It was, or his affliction, as we've seen, was a direct result of his refusal to go to Nineveh. Now, our distress could be caused by several other things, not necessarily in the same category as Jonah's, although, of course, it might be. Other times, distress or suffering could come in order to prevent future wrongs rather than to correct past ones. And a good example of that would be Jonah, wouldn't it, Joseph, when he was sold into slavery. Incidentally, I suspect that Joseph could not always make sense of the suffering that he was going through while it was happening. Points again to a God who looks at the bigger picture, much bigger than the one that we have available to us. And often we simply don't know, do we, why suffering, affliction, trials have been sent. But it could be to lead a person to love God more fully for himself alone and to discover that ultimate peace and freedom in him. More important than the suffering or the distress is our response to it, isn't it? So when calamity strikes or distress calls, we're not so bothered perhaps about all the things around us, the stuff that we've accumulated over time. No, at that point, we remember that no one else but God can help us. Only then, so often, do we remember the God that we claim to believe in. And so Jonah prayed to the Lord his God and experienced his grace, as we shall see. Now, in all of this, we have to see, as Jonah saw, that the God we worship is sovereign over events. And we'll know that from even a cursory reading of the Bible. And while we say we believe it, and I say I believe it often enough, in reality, we often live as though we don't. Sinclair Ferguson, who's a preacher in the Free Church of Scotland, confirms this when he says this: few principles are more important in the Christian life than the practical recognition of the sovereign God and his gracious determination to draw us near to himself, whatever the cost may be. He continues, when his purposes involve afflictions and sufferings of any kind, the knowledge that he is sovereignly overruling is the only thing that can preserve us from a craven fear or a sense of despair and bring us a measure of joyful and willing acceptance of our situation. Only when we recognize God's aim is to make us like Christ and that he works all the events of our lives together for this purpose will we begin to rejoice in the good that is produced out of tribulation. And one other example that many of you will know through her writings, Joni Erickson Tada. She has a view as well on suffering and sovereignty. If you know the history, she had a diving accident when she was 17 back in 1967, which left her as a quadriplegic. And you would think if anybody had the right to be bitter, you would think, well, maybe that's her. But she says this. She said, I really don't mind the inconvenience of being paralyzed. If my faithfulness to God while in the wheelchair will bring glory to him. When God brings suffering into your life as a Christian, be it mild or drastic, he's forcing you to decide on issues you've been avoiding. Am I going to continue trying to live in two worlds, obeying Christ and my own sinful desires? Or am I going to refuse to worry? Am I going to be grateful in trials? Just think about that. Am I going to be grateful in trials? Am I going to abandon my sins? In short, am I going to be like Christ? He provides the suffering, but the choice is yours. And then just summarizing, she says, but today as I look back, I'm convinced that the whole ordeal of my paralysis was inspired by his love. I wasn't a rat in a maze. I wasn't the brunt of some cruel divine joke. God had reasons behind my suffering. And then this is striking, isn't it? And learning some of them has made all the difference in the world. Well, what an amazing response to suffering that is. Friends, what do you do? What do I do when we're in distress or we experience suffering? Just complain bitterly that it should happen? Blame Murphy's Law, perhaps? Shrug your shoulders in disbelief? Give God reasons why you shouldn't be suffering? You know, maybe he's forgotten your particular case and you need to remind him of that. You know, we resent suffering so much, don't we? We've asked for prayer when we have coughs and colds. We're so anti-suffering ourselves. But do we have any right to expect that in a world that's so terribly broken, as we so often hear, by the effects of sin, that suffering should somehow overlook us? That we should somehow be exempt because we're Christians? One American writer, I think it was Tim Keller, states that because the meaning of life in the United States is the pursuit of pleasure and personal freedom, that suffering is so traumatic for Americans. Just gets in the way of what we want to do. There's one song that I'm not going to sing, but I'm going to read, that puts this into perspective. I used it in our home group a few months ago, actually. It says simply this, just two verses. Shall I take from your hand your blessings, yet not welcome any pain? Shall I thank you for days of sunshine, yet grumble in days of rain? Shall I love you in times of plenty, then leave you in days of drought? Shall I trust when I reap the harvest, but when winter winds blow, then doubt? And then the second verse, are you good only when I prosper, and true only when I'm filled? Are you king only when I'm carefree, and God only when I'm well? You are good when I'm poor and needy. You are true when I'm parched and dry. You still reign in the deepest valley. You're still God in the darkest night. Well, Jonah here was at a very low ebb, wasn't he? He couldn't have been in any more trouble without his life being taken away from him. Verse 2, from the depths of the grave I cried for help. Verse 3, you hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas. The currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I've been banished from your sight, verse 4. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. Jonah was really in distress, wasn't he? He really was. And I think it's safe to assume that inside the fish, although I think this is a very nice looking fish, but inside the fish is not how is depicted by some Bible storybooks, you know, some cavernous space. I've even seen some with a desk and a chair and a light hanging from the ceiling or whatever it is that's above Jonah's head. But he was in a bad way. But he knew that through this experience that God was showing grace to him and showing his compassion. He knew that the fish, as uncomfortable and as claustrophobic as it may have been, was still the vehicle of his deliverance, and he knew that. So having just looked at Jonah's distress for a few moments and drawn out one or two lessons for us, I just want to focus now on Jonah's deliverance. So verse 7, when my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord. Well, we can sit in judgment, can't we, on Jonah, and we probably do. I have often enough, as I've looked to both chapter 1 and chapter 2. We criticize him for not obeying God's command to go to Nineveh in chapter 1. We wag a self-righteous finger at him. And, you know, I almost find myself saying, do you know what, Jonah? You could have saved yourself a pile of trouble here if you'd have just remembered God a bit earlier, not waited until your life was ebbing away. And I then think of my own life and realize how hypocritical I can be when it comes to remembering God. And maybe it's just best to keep some of those judgments to myself. Now, Jonah turned from God, but God did not turn from Jonah. And I just wonder, what does God need to do to us in order that we might remember him? Moving on to verse 8. What a tremendous verse that is. Now, we've heard a lot about idols recently. But I think this is tremendous, isn't it? Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Now, for Jonah here, he may have been thinking back into what we now know as chapter 1 on the boat, verse 5, when all the mariners were seeking help from their idols in the eye of the storm. And the message is clear, isn't it? Idols don't help us. Indeed, they can't. And yes, we can relate this to our own day and generation, and we can identify our own idols. Could be, I don't know what yours is, or what mine is. Well, I know what mine is, but I'll keep that to myself, I think. Perhaps the idol of wealth, of career, of relationship, of house, of travel, of possessions, or of power and of human acceptance, or the idol of control. You know, in real distress or affliction, do those provide answers for us or give us any security? But what about also some other idols? What about the idol of a nice, quiet Christian life that really doesn't demand too much of me? Could that be an idol too? You know, we can praise ourselves, can't we, for being perhaps not too attracted to wealth and, well, careers isn't a big thing for me, or holidays. Then we just end up making an idol of our humility. Friends, this is searching stuff, isn't it? And what is it the Bible says about our righteousness? It's like filthy rags, and that's the best bits. You know, in the sight of a holy God, there's nothing about us that's very attractive at all. And that's why Christ is so necessary for us, as the only one that can make us attractive to God, because he was without sin. He took all of that sin on himself and suffered for you and for me as a sacrifice for sin, a more intense suffering than you or I will ever experience. You know, indeed, people often ask, don't they, if there's a God, then why does he allow suffering at all? Well, because the rules that God made for his creation have been broken. Yes, initially by Adam and Eve as our representatives, but we continue breaking them today. The perfect world that he made has been marred by sin. And that's what is sin. It's simply a breaking of God's laws. We live our own way, don't we, so often without any reference to God. But friends, if we believe that the Bible is true, we will know that this is God's world. And we play the game of life by his rules, because he made the world. They're not our rules. So with that disobedience of our first parents came sin and came suffering. But God has said, it won't always be like this. And he urges us to turn to him, to believe in him while we still have the opportunity, and look forward to that time and place where there will be no more sin, where there will be no more suffering, and we're in heaven eternally. So how should a Christian rightly respond to suffering? Well, one writer that I was looking at recently said that when disaster and suffering strike, the right response is to acknowledge the fragility of life and make sure that we're ready to have it taken from us. Sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it? But that was certainly Jonah's position. Although he came to the realization of it a bit late, he did get there, didn't he, in the end? He recognized the state he was in. His life was ebbing away. But I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you. Now, you might say, well, that's a very weak and submissive response. Maybe you're someone who always comes out fighting. You stand up for your rights to get the best outcome you can. But, you know, in God's world, the world that he made, the world that we believe he made, and everything in it, you know, he created those rules by which we live. They're all right here. They're all right here in the Bible. That's where they are. But when disaster and suffering strike, life does seem fragile. And in fact, the older you become, life seems more fragile, as certain ailments and life-threatening diseases are spoken about much more often than they ever were when you were younger. Well, that might seem strange if you're young, if you've had nothing more than the flu or a sore knee or something. But all sorts of things can remind us of life's fragility. Just watch the news if you need ideas. I'm reminded of the guy in the parable who wanted to pull down his barns in the New Testament, Luke chapter 12. God had other plans. He said, this night your soul will be required of you, and then who shall those things be that you've made for yourself? Well, that's why we need to turn to God, isn't it? So that when life in this world comes to an end, we're well set up for the world to come. Jonah, he's got the answer here. Verse 9, salvation is of the Lord, or salvation comes from the Lord. You know, it's paradoxical, isn't it, really, that suffering can and often does bring us closer to God. Sometimes it awakens us to the reality of God if we're not Christians. Why do so many believers turn to him, even if it's superficially, in times of national distress? Or, you know, a large bombing or something. You know, when prayer starts trending on social media. Why instead aren't people turning away from him and saying, this is just another reason why I don't believe in God? It just makes no sense. And for others who are already believers, you know, it often enhances their relationship with God. I remember talking to someone whose husband had left her. And she was saying how particular verses of the Bible were so helpful. You know, she was captivated by what God was saying to her. And I was trying to look as interested as I could and thinking, well, I kind of see your point. But, you know, in a sense, I'd missed the point completely. You know, at that moment, God was drawing her close to himself and delivering her in her distress, not to me. And then I heard of another couple who I've known in the church setting for a number of years. What I didn't know until very recently was that they'd lost a daughter to an accident when she was only 6 or 7. You just think of the pain and the torment running out over in their minds, thinking maybe they could have done something differently and maybe the accident wouldn't have happened. But have they used that as a reason not to believe in God? No, far from it. Think of Johnny Erickson Tada, quoted earlier. Delivered from her initial distress from the diving accident. Don't want you to think that she had a diving accident and she was, you know, she completely got God's will straight away. No, 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 it took a while. But then in another book I've been reading about walking with God through pain and suffering, there's a number of case studies, all harrowing and beyond the level of suffering that most of us will probably experience. And I'm reading these and I'm thinking, where's the happy ending? But you know, there isn't a happy ending in the way that we've come to understand happiness in our culture. In one case, which is representative of all the others, this lady Mary says, after giving the details of all that's happened to her, and I really don't want to go through what that is, she says this. She says, life has not changed, but God is changing me. What I discovered about heartaches and problems, especially the ones that are beyond what we can handle, is that maybe those are the problems he does permit, precisely because we cannot handle them, or the pain and the anxiety they cause, but he can. I think he wants us to realize that trusting him to handle these situations is actually a gift. Problems don't disappear and life continues, but he replaces the sting of those heartaches with hope, which has been an amazing realization. She says, I've come to believe that life will not always be as it is now, and that's key. I find even more comfort in being able to stop focusing on all the heartache and focus on the one who will someday take heartache away completely and forever. I spent my entire life looking for and never finding a recipe to go from despair to hope. It did not come from anything I did or didn't do. Hope comes not in the solution to the problem, but in focusing on Christ, who facilitates the change. You know, her relationship with God, like that of Johnny Erickson, has not been enhanced despite the suffering, but through the suffering. And I could go on and on with examples. You know, I sometimes think we come to church, don't we, think everybody's fine. Yeah, you ask somebody, how are you? Well, the answer you get, I guess 95% of the time, is fine. It's the answer I give most frequently. And yet, you know, often we can be utterly clueless, can't we, about what's going on in the lives of those that we talk to. What pain and suffering that they've had to endure, or what they're enduring right now. You know, we pitch up on a Sunday so often, we think everybody else has life sorted out except for us because we're going through it. But friends, if you're envious of the lives of others because you don't think they have a hard time, then you probably just don't know them well enough. Well, we should conclude. Maybe for some of you here, this all seems irrelevant. In fact, in one of the books about suffering I was reading, it was acknowledged by the authors that when they first had the idea of the book about suffering, they hadn't suffered themselves so much as an ingrowing toenail. However, subsequently suffering came to them, and you can be sure that it will come to you too. You know, it may be physical suffering or disease, an accident maybe, perhaps a bereavement. It may be severe emotional suffering in a relationship with your husband, with your wife, your relatives, or some in your church family. It could be so many things. But as our last song declares, when trials come, not if they come. So where do you stand now? Are you bored or fed up with Christianity? Is it not bringing you the outcomes that you think it should? Are you feeling a bit like the old REM song that you're losing my religion? Do you think that as a Christian, your life should be more carefree because, you know, you're one of the good guys following Christ? Why does bad stuff still happen to me? As I said earlier, we live, don't we, in a sinful world, a broken world, and we're not immune from the effects of rebellion against God. You know, there's lots I don't know about pain and suffering and the problem of evil. But I do know this, that the Bible clearly states that a time is coming when God will no longer witness the sin that we all see around us. He'll bring the world to an end as we know it and usher in his kingdom. The Bible calls it heaven. A place where, as we heard a few months ago when Spencer was preaching through Revelation, a place where we're told that God will wipe away every tear. A place where there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Well, that's what we should look forward to in the midst of suffering. And the Bible tells us there'll be no second chances on that day. So if you're not a Christian, you won't be able to claim that, well, I came to Emmanuel a few Sundays so that God should save you. You know, all that we've considered tonight does point to the fact, doesn't it, that life is fragile. And are we ready for it to be taken from us? Remember Jonah's cry in verse 9 that salvation comes from the Lord. Jonah knows he's been delivered. In truth, he probably wrote all of this when he was looking back on the experience sometime later, which is why it's recounted so clearly for us. He makes solemn promises in verse 9 that he will perform. And having been delivered and learnt his big lesson, he's vomited onto dry land and will now carry out God's command to preach to the Ninevites as God gives him a second chance. Well, there's a book out there on the table in the foyer. Good book. It's entitled, If I Could Ask God One Question. Well, I wonder what you would ask. You know, would it be something like, why do you allow suffering? Or why don't you end all the pain? Or perhaps a more specific question, you know, more personal to you alone. But maybe we should turn the question around. What about if God could ask one question of us? I wonder what that would be. If you're not a Christian, it may be something like, well, why don't you turn to me before it's too late? Or don't you see the need to have your sins forgiven? Or if you're already a Christian, it may be something like this. Why don't you live as though you believe in me? Or why do you only turn to me when trials come?